class today. One is Caroline. She's a GSI. So she's just observing. And I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Janine.
Janine. She's going to tell you a little bit more about what she's doing. That's why we have a microphone, just so you all know what's going on and consent to it.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit now about what's going on. My name is Janine, and I'm here on behalf of the U of M's English Language Institute. We're recording this class today as part of a research project started in winter of 98 to collect about 175 hours of spoken English from a wide range of academic settings. The purpose of collecting the data, formally called a corpus, is to provide a source of authentic speech for use in English language teaching and testing materials in linguistic research. Your instructor has given us preliminary permission to do the recording with the understanding that no identifying information, like last names, for instance, will be used in the transcript. Your participation in today's class implies your consent to the recording and to the use of the data for teaching and research purposes, unless you approach us after class and let us know that there's something that you said that you don't want on the tape. One of the ways the transcript will be used is part of an online web-accessible database available to linguists for research purposes. The website is hosted by the university's Humanities Text Initiative, so it's a legitimate thing, and since it's all anonymous and you can pretty much only access it through the HTI website, you really don't have any confidentiality concerns. So does anybody have any questions or objections? Or okay, then I guess.
Do we have to do it? I didn't do the whole thing.
Oh, you're not required to, but since we have pretty much a primary speaker, if you don't want your speech included in the transcript or put up on the web, then you can let us know afterwards and we can take it off the test. That we can take it either off the tape or we can just not include that in the transcript.
I'm sorry, I hope you guys are not feeling under pressure. I mean, I didn't learn about this until today either, but the professor said it was okay. So
if anybody has any concerns, if you have specific questions, I'm happy to address them. People aren't going to be going to the website and looking up your particular speech and being like, oh, I can't believe you said such a stupid thing.
No, I didn't hear the whole thing you said because there's a disturbance back here.
Oh, okay. Basically, what we're doing is collecting a large database of spoken English that linguists can go to and run certain types of text analysis on, like a particular type of word search to look to see lexical or syntactic patterns that occur frequently so that we can develop materials for non-native speakers.
So basically, we're helping people to develop curriculum for English as a second language classes. So if sounds like a good cause, right? And they're not interested in what we say at all. It's
we're not at all interested in content, teaching style, speaking style. We don't care if you cuss. We don't care if you do anything really. We're just looking for natural speech data. Okay.
Alright. So I hope that's not going to make you all self-conscious. Because we won't have a very good class if you are. But today I wanted to talk about, partially talk about the lectures that we had this week, which were about political systems. And I wanted to start off doing that by talking about power and social organization, social control. Maybe you want to talk to her after just to make sure that you know what's going on with that. So you had some reading on this in your textbook. I thought it was pretty advanced, a lot of the concepts that we talked about in there, so maybe we could just talk about how these sort of apply to your own experiences. So I was hoping you could just sort of throw out some ideas about how social control works in our society. Basically, why do you do all of the things that you do? If you go into a store and you see something that you really want and you can't afford it, why don't you just take it? Assuming that you don't, of course. Yes.
When you're younger, you do.
Okay, no, that's a good point, actually. So let's keep that in mind.
Sometimes when you're older, you still feel like you're a criminal.
Sure. I mean, social control is obviously not perfect. So, So young people, what does that tell us about young people? If young people are more likely to, say, steal something. You might want to talk to her after class just to find out what she's doing and whether you want to participate in it.
Okay.
So what does that tell us already? If young people are more likely to steal things than older people. Yeah.
Either that they're more rebellious, or just that they're not as accustomed to society's norms yet.
Yeah, rebellious, or not. We could call it socialized, which basically just means they're not accustomed to society's norms yet. Yeah.
Or they're just too young to understand the consequences.
And this is important. Consequences. Somebody else has something they want to
say? There also isn't as many consequences.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, why do you think that there are not as many consequences? I mean, why is our society set up so that there won't be as many consequences? I mean, that's absolutely true, but I mean, why? What is the value behind that? What is the idea behind that? Yeah.
I think we could talk about like the 6-year-old boy with like the gun, obviously. You know.
Yeah.
It's like they live in a dream world, kind of. You know how you have like when you're young, you have like imaginary friends, and like you just have like your own little world. You know, you really believe it.
That's definitely important. Yeah.
Kids, the only consequence like of stealing is getting what they're stealing. Like there's no like punishment. And for the kid like shooting that girl to him, he was like repaying her for hitting him. Because I think that was a thing. Like that was the only consequence. He doesn't think he was gonna kill her. I mean, he doesn't. He just thinks he's gonna pay her back. Like,
but he only like understood death by how the movie portrayed it. Like big deal. Like another one. Like in T2, like thousands of people died. You know.
So why is it that young children don't understand, say, about what it means to kill somebody? I mean, it's not a difficult question, really. I'm just trying to get you to really spell it out. Sorry?
I mean, when you're little, your parents don't expose you to that. Like, my parents, like, when my grandparents died and I was, like, 4 or 5, they didn't take me to the funeral, so, like, I was never exposed to death until I was, like, old enough to, like, handle it.
So basically, if young people are not socialized and they're protected, they're not yet socialized, they're protected, the period of youth is one, I mean, I'm sort of drawing on your comments and sort of adding to them, but the period of youth is one where people get socialized, where people get taught what they need to know in order to live in society, say. And they're protected so that they don't learn everything too fast. Is that one of the values of our society? I mean, you've probably heard that before. What is it that they're being taught? I mean, for one thing, they're being taught consequences, right? So they didn't know what the consequences are. What else? Yeah.
They don't know the difference between right and wrong for a certain amount of time. So if you teach them everything, if you teach them how to like use a gun, then they don't know if it's right or wrong to use a gun.
Yeah, so they're being taught morals. Did you have something to say?
Yeah.
What else? Anything else that they're being taught? Yeah.
Well, it's like a lot of times when you see movies, kids are exposed. Kids are exposed to some murders. Later on, like they have problems. You know what I mean? If they're exposed to something too early, later on they have problems. Like being abused, you know, later on they have problems. It's like kind of like.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. So I guess it falls under the category of. Kept them from learning things too quickly. Is there a connection between consequences and morals? I mean, basically these are things, both of them, that our society has decided that someone. It's not. I mean, it's not something that, you know, everyone in the society obviously sat down and decided. But somehow we've come to this agreement that young people need to learn consequences, and they need to learn morals. Yeah.
I think they use consequences to teach morals.
Yeah, that's a good one. So basically, what kinds of consequences are there? I mean, there's one consequence, like you were saying, the boy shoots a little girl and she dies, and that's sort of a natural consequence. What other kind of consequences are there that might be useful to teach morals? Punishment, yeah. So there's punishment, and there's natural consequences. So basically, children are young. They're being taught that if they do certain things, there'll be certain punishments, and that's because. There's underlying morals, right, that lead us to punish them for doing certain things. So, I mean, do you think that those are absolutely true, the morals and the consequences, or do you think that they're somewhat arbitrary and decided by each society, each culture, separately? I mean, for example, we're talking about lots of different societies today, right? We talked about the band, tribe, state typology. So one of the things that Dr. Kotek said was that in the band, tribes, and chiefdoms, it's important for the leaders to be very generous and give a lot of gifts to the people, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas he said, in a state society, people have more freedom to collect goods and they don't have to redistribute them. So that's sort of a difference in morals, right? I mean, so do you think that there are morals that are absolute, or do you think that all morals are cultural? Yeah.
I don't think it's really a difference. I think that bands, tribes, and chiefdoms, they had to do that to get people to follow and support them. But if they couldn't, like, just kept it all themselves, they would.
Maybe so. I mean, I'm not saying that's not true, but it's a standard of that society, right? Yeah.
I think all morals are created. Like, you look at World War II, and, you know, murder wasn't bad anymore because you were, as long as you can, like, justify your actions, you can create any moral.
Yeah, that's an interesting point of view. Yeah.
I was gonna say that I think morals are all the same, but I think different cultures rank the importance of different morals accordingly. Just like an example is if you compare Eastern thought with Western thought over any random topic, it's like.
Eastern thought is very group oriented, you know, like, you know, you acquiesce to the person above you, or, you know, someone like someone that you should hold more respect for. And Western thought is very, like, individualistic and, you know, personal rights and all that stuff. So I think morals are basically the same from culture to culture, but it depends on the way they rank the importance of each one.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it. I like that.
Yeah, basically you said that in some way you can have both. You can say that there are morals which are universal, but culture still plays a big role in determining which morals take precedence. And that's actually something, there's a really famous philosopher who wrote something very, very similar to that, so just in case you're interested. Alistair McIntyre. I don't know, just to let you know. But yeah, he's a really well-respected philosopher, says something very similar. Yeah.
As for like whether or not there are absolute morals, I definitely think that there are whether or not they're universal morals is, I don't think, ever going to be known, whether or not they're socially constructed or whatnot. But definitely, I think like something as extreme as a child killing someone, some are more. Like are more obvious than others, and haven't been known to like work like certain actions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't think there's any universal morals. You look back in time before like monotheistic religion, and they would sacrifice people to God. As long as you believe, like you have that faith that, I don't know how to put it in words really, but give me a minute, I'll come back to it. But as long, like I was saying, as long as you can justify it, it's okay. Like, I don't think that over time there's been no moral that's been completely universal.
So what does that mean to justify it? Like how do we justify?
Like you're sacrificing the person for God or for like a higher reason.
If it's culturally justified.
Yeah, I think
society
yeah.
doesn't have a problem with it as a whole, then there's no punishment, there's no shame in doing it. It's common practice.
I think there's a lot of truth to that point, too. Yeah. Did you want to... I'm sorry. You got your point. It's the second time that happened to you today. yeah, I think that's a good point.
I think that like, it has a lot to do with like looking at other cultures from like your own culture. Like we can look at them and say like that it's a bad thing. It's not moral for our... Like, but then they look at it, it is moral. So it's, like, it's hard to say. Like, you can't like... look at other cultures, like, and whatever, say if they're right or wrong, and it's, like, hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, that's like cultural relativism, which we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. Definitely becomes important. Yeah.
And, like, not to stereotype, but, like, some gypsy tribes, it's, like, to steal is how they survive. You know, like, moving from one place to another, like, stealing. That's how they get by. It's not amoral to them, or immoral to them.
Oh, sorry, wait. I'm going to give her precedence because she always has her point taken away.
about the gypsy thing, but, like, if it's justified to them, but they pay consequences if they're in our society, because that's wrong in our society.
Right,
that's
but not within their own.
So that, I mean, that's an interesting point, though, because we were talking about consequences, and, I mean, there could be cases where consequences and morals are not related. So, and this is something also to think about with this typology, actually, because this is something that I wanted to get to in class today. I mean, we talk about all these different types of governments, right? But at the bottom line, in the year 2000, are there really any band, tribe, or chiefdom governments? I mean, the answer is no. There are bands, tribes, and chiefdoms, but they all live in states. So gypsies would be an example of that phenomenon. State governments all over the world have the ultimate power, and they can assert their own consequences and their own morals over these other types of organizations, which may still exist, but they're not...
they're not really governments anymore in that ultimate sense.
You know, like the Amazon is still a little bit.
Sorry?
They're in the Amazon where they really have no contact.
They
the tribes have no contact at all.
Well, they do. I mean, that's an interesting situation to bring up. I mean, they do have contact with the government at this point. I think this was discussed in your book, but maybe even 35 years ago, there would have been tribes that had pretty much autonomy, but now, really, they don't. I mean, if they want to get some kind of rights, you know, there's different competing groups. Say there's miners who want to go in and or loggers that want to go in and use the land. The tribes also have something that they want to do on the land, and it's really the state that has to mediate. Just like Dr. Kotek was talking about today, with how on the coast of Peru, he was saying that different groups expand, they come into conflict, and then a larger government forms to mediate, and that's sort of, you can look at it the same way there. Yeah.
It's kind of like the situation in Nico, because they thought they were living by their own rules and stuff in another cult, you know, in another set of consequences. So, I mean, it's kind of, even though their morals are different, they still have to pay the consequences of the rest of their surroundings.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And I mean, in some cases, I mean, they weren't successful, and maybe we're glad of that. Or, I mean, not that they were treated fairly, of course, but maybe we're glad that they didn't, you know, weren't able to secede and form their own country or whatever. But, I mean, that can be something that ends up having consequences for state governments as a whole. If groups form that have their own values, they can end up challenging and changing the way that the larger society is structured. So that's another thing to think about with the whole issue of power and social control. We were talking about morals. I think morals are really central to this, but there's other things, there are other types of control besides morals that are exerted on us, I think. For example, let's say coming to class, right? It's not immoral to cut class. Well, maybe, I mean, you could maybe someone could make an argument like, I don't know, your parents paid all this money and you made a promise to them to go to class, and so it's immoral to cut class. But let's say for the sake of argument, you know, you paid your own tuition, it's your own choice, but you're still here, you came to class. Hopefully part of the reason is because you like coming to class and you're learning something and you're, you know. But in some cases, maybe not in this class, but in some class that you've taken, you probably didn't really like it or really get that much out of it, but you still went to class anyway. Not because it was immoral not to go, but why?
The grade.
I mean, this still gets back to consequences, definitely, social consequences. And that's one reason. Do you think that's the only reason? Or if you do come to class because you're getting something out of it, say you're learning something that you want to learn, what is it that makes you want to learn these particular things? Why have you decided that the kind of things that you can learn by going to class at a university are more worth knowing or more worth spending your time on than, say, the kind of things you could learn by camping? Yeah.
Maybe if you have, like, higher aspirations, like, if you have, like, some kind of goal later in life that you want to achieve, and you can't really achieve that by going camping all day.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important... I mean, that's related to consequences, but it's separate. I mean, yeah, definitely goals are important. And that's, for a lot of people, that's the reason why they do go to school. What if you, I mean, there must be someone like this in the class, like me, when I was your age. What if you really don't know what you want to do, when you graduate from college. I mean, chances are probably that going to college is going to help you with whatever you end up deciding to do. But if you really don't know what you're going to do, how do you know that going to college is a good thing? I mean, what is it? Yeah.
Because you've seen it work for other people. And so
yeah, that's true. Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's important. That's an important part of socialization is imitation. And you sort of have to trust that things will go the same way for you that they go for other people. Yeah.
It's also not exactly a bad thing to learn new information. I mean, even if a college education isn't going to be exactly what you're going to, if it's not going to take you what you want to be, it's not exactly a bad thing to learn new stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Definitely. But how do you know what kind of stuff that you want to learn? How do you know what kind of stuff is more important or more valuable? Yeah.
You have to experience it all, and then you get to decide after that.
I mean, that's definitely true. Within some boundaries, right? Though. Yeah.
I think it's also, to some extent, social conditions, social norms. Like when you're talking about something as broad as a college, you know, in our society, it's the thing that you should do. You know, you should go to college if you were in high school and you were smart. Like if you meet someone and you know they were really smart in high school and then they said, "Yeah, I just didn't want to go to college," most of us would think, you know, what's wrong with this person? And you know, in other societies, it's like to not go to, you know, after you graduate from high school, it's natural for them just to go into the workplace and they don't think twice about going to college. So I think it's also social norms and that kind of thing. It doesn't really apply to something specific as going to class, going like skipping class. But when you're talking about going to college, I think it does.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And that's probably a point that's more related to anthropology. But I mean, I hope this isn't seeming like too much information to y'all, but I guess what I'm trying to get at by getting you to give me all these different answers is how, first of all, social life is really complex, and there are social norms, but then there are also other factors that help people to choose between different social norms, and even factors that influence people to go outside of social norms. But the social norms are still existing, they still have some kind of interaction with these other factors. So by throwing all of these things out, I hope that you're starting to think about how these things might fit together. How do social norms relate to the goals? I mean, this is really just building on what you said, but when we set goals, how do we decide what our goals should be? I mean, do you think, for example, that if someone didn't go to college, it means they're going to be miserable for the rest of their life and their life is worthless? I mean, probably not. I hope you don't think that. But yet you still set a goal that involved going to college. So, I mean, I think that has something to do with social norms. I mean, what does anyone have any more points on that? Or what kind of, yeah.
I mean, it just depends what makes you happy. Like, if I was George Bush's son, the first one, I probably wouldn't have even gone to school. You know, I would have had all the money. I wouldn't have wanted to be a politician. I would have been happy, you know.
Well, yeah, and there's
a job for my dad.
There's another question. This is a really good point that you bring up. I mean, we say that, and maybe you would. I mean, I'm not saying you wouldn't. But there's lots of people in the world. Take Bill Gates, you know, for an example, who make lots of money, have lots of money, or other people who inherit lots of money. They don't have to work, but they do.
It makes them happy.
Why does it make them happy?
Gives their life, like, self-worth.
Well, you need something to do. You go crazy when you're, like, stagnant and have nothing to do. So.
I mean, there's definitely...
there's definitely some truth to this. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but on the other hand, think about, did you ever read any novels by Jane Austen, say, or see any of the movies? I mean, those people didn't do anything, right? I mean, they play the piano and draw a little bit and write a letter and go out for a walk. And it didn't seem to bother them. I mean, having lots of money to them basically meant they didn't have to do anything and they were happy about it, right? So why is it that that we don't? Yeah.
Like, maybe it was a little more socially accepted in that time period. It seems now everybody, if you're not doing something, then people really question why you're not doing anything, since everybody's so busy and there's...
Yeah. I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's what I would say. Yeah.
Even doing that gives you something to do. It's just in a different context. I mean, just people need, like, some sense of accomplishment, like, in their lives to know that they're doing something. I mean, obviously it'd be great if it's always, you know, for a worthy cause, but even just playing the piano can give yourself some self-satisfaction that you can maybe, you know, show it to other people or, you know, bring it to other areas.
I mean, I think that's true, that people, and we are always doing something, definitely, and that's an important point. But I mean, I just want to emphasize that we've gotten back again to the social norms. I mean, in our society, there's a norm that says people should be doing something all the time. What's wrong with you if you're not doing something? In that society, while people still, I mean, it wasn't, you know, they didn't sit in a chair and stare at the wall all day, but there is a different definition of what it means to have a sense of accomplishment or what it means to do something. So that's another way that that culture sort of determines, in a way, or helps to determine, I should say, what we do. So I mean, why do we have these beliefs and social norms? I mean, what do you think? How did we get this idea that we should be doing something all the time? Or how did we get this idea that, or how did you get an idea that you should go to college, even though maybe some other people? Yeah.
I think a lot of it gets related to, like, your parents. Like, I know my parents have a strong push for education, it always comes first. Whereas, like, in school, you always see, like, people whose parents, like, push as hard, and then I like, it's really to the child, and they don't care so much. But then there's people whose parents don't care, and then they care a lot.
Definitely. I mean, I think it definitely has a lot to do with your parents. I mean, some things, you know, are really different for different parents. Different parents emphasize different kind of goals, and some things that maybe all parents within a certain society all share. So that's really important. Yeah.
I think a lot of it also has to do with what you choose to sort of, like, latch on to, like, whether it's your parents or what you see on TV, and it sort of all develops as you get older, and, like, sometimes for people it's, like, gangs, they see, you know, and, you know, that's, you sort of start to form those things. Or
yeah. Yeah, and I mean that's a really important way of putting it too, that within the category that you could call social norms, there's all these different choices that people can make. They can choose to follow their parents, they can choose to follow TV, which is still setting up another kind of norm in a way, because when you watch TV, I mean, think about this next time that you watch TV, because I think you'll notice. A lot of shows have some kind of moral lesson or some kind of values that they're promoting. Either, you know, crime is bad, or family harmony is good, or something about love and relationships. There's all different kinds of societal norms that you can see really explicitly in TV programs. And then there's also the peers, which are society. You know, sometimes perhaps if it's gangs, maybe it's not the most healthy or productive way to kind of society, part of our society, you could argue, but
still, peers and kind of peer pressure is a kind of social norm. And I mean, especially in a really big society like ours, in a state society, there are different factors and different choices that, you know, in a band, maybe there wouldn't be quite as many, but there are different influences that can come in. Did you have something to say?
I was going to say that, you know, social norm is such a broad category. You know, it covers shaking hands, you know, as well as, like, I don't know, helping an old lady across the street or something. But I think in industrialized nations, the state plays a really large part in monitoring or at least tweaking social norms to their, you know, to their preference, so that it all plays together to help the state function most effectively.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point, and a lot of people do say that the state, the state definitely has an interest, right, in keeping society ordered, and making sure that people fill different tasks in society. You know, if no one wanted to work at McDonald's, then no one could ever eat there, for example. So the state definitely has an interest in promoting certain kinds of norms. But how does, I mean, and this is a really, you know, it's kind of almost a philosophical question, so I don't expect you all to be able to answer it right now, but how do these norms get from the state or from some body of government to the people? How does the state control people? I mean, it's, yeah.
I mean, just in every connection that the state has with, you know, in terms of politicians' speeches, in their censorship of the media, you know, in their dealings with religious leaders, and I mean, there's so much literature on, you know, how religion is just, it's, I forget what the quote is, but it's a pill for the people.
Oh yeah,
like,
I mean, there's some.
Marx.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is that's Marx. Marcus, you said that.
Religion is the ether of the opiate of people.
Opiate of the masses,
opiate.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's another whole. I should put it up here too. That's another whole area where norms can come from, religion. And I mean, what is the connection between state and religion? That's another kind of interesting topic, because as you probably all are thinking right now, we have the idea of separation of church and state in the United States. So there's a belief, an attempt that these two things should be separate, but in some sense they're not. I remember when I went to Taiwan, for some reason that was the first time that I realized this, that all of our government offices close on Christmas. They don't close on any other religious holidays or other religions, but they always close on Christmas. So that's already something. It's not huge, but I mean, some kind of acknowledgement that the state gives preferential treatment to certain religions over others. Not that I'm saying necessarily that they shouldn't do that. I think it's almost impossible to completely separate church from state. Yeah,
I was just going to say, I mean, all you have to do is just look at the Republican Party, and you can see very well that religion and state are definitely not separated. You know, like, there's such a huge Christian coalition and
that's true.
And all that. You know,
yeah,
and
there's
making the laws. It's people that are religious, so, you know, it's impossible to separate religion and state, really. And look at the Constitution. You know, all men created under God. Religion is a belief in God. Not everyone believes in God. You know, so you can't. I mean, even starting from that point, it was flash.
Well, that's true. I mean, religious people are making the laws. You know, they're going to follow their convictions. They would be unethical not to follow their convictions. That's certainly true. yeah, it's I mean, if we're talking about morals, I mean, that has to be always connected to religion. Definitely. Does anyone want to stand up for the separation of church and state? Yeah.
I definitely think though that I don't know like how far we've come, but a lot of people have this notion that it should either happen overnight or that it can never happen, and rather than believing that it can happen gradually. And something like church and state, I mean, as connected as they still might be, I mean, not necessarily as much. And you know, again, when people have think that it should just happen like that, you know, usually the consequences are negative.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, when people try to suddenly separate church from state when they had been really connected, you can have lots of problems. Like, I don't know if you've all been following what goes on in Turkey. I mean, I haven't followed it as much as I'd like to, but you might remember last year there was a woman who was wearing a headscarf in the legislature, and they... kicked her out of the legislature for doing that. I mean, that wouldn't happen in the United States because we have this idea of freedom of religion. So we'd say that people should be able to follow their religion, and that shouldn't prevent them from holding government offices. But in Turkey there, I mean, they had a really religious government. The government was the religion. It was all tied together. Completely tied together, and they're just trying to rip it apart in this kind of radical way within the last, say, 100 years. And so it's led to these kind of really harsh laws to try to separate it out. So that's an interesting point. But then, I mean, on the other hand, you could say that, I mean, are we moving towards separating church and state? I don't know. All the candidates, and there's been a lot of talk in the newspapers about how all the candidates have to talk about their religious beliefs as part of their campaigns in the current election. That might be more true now than it was, I don't know, 8 years ago or whatever. Yeah.
Well, my understanding of the Constitution, it says separation of church from the state, but it doesn't mean that the religion can't have a say in the state, because the whole meaning of that was that the state couldn't overtake religion like they were doing in Great Britain. So there's no way that you can sit there and say, you know, you can't bring your religious beliefs into politics, because it's a part of your everyday life, and then that'd be crossing your constitutional right of freedom of religion. So I think if a candidate wants to tell their religious belief, I go for it. I mean, but I totally disagree with the whole the state and the religion can't be intermixed, because the whole purpose of that was that the state couldn't tell people about their religious beliefs. Not that religion.
I mean, I think
the state.
I mean, the answer that I would give to that, just, you know, devil's advocate or whatever, is that maybe the arrow has to be two way if there's a connection at all, because if someone brings their religious beliefs into politics, say, and then enacts laws based on their religious beliefs, and other people have different beliefs, you know, that are totally, completely different, then somehow the first person's beliefs are infringing on the second person. You could say. I mean, or not. Just to throw out an argument. But I mean, I think that just because, you know, I could make that argument doesn't mean that what you're saying is not true, because all of these things could be ideals that we could try to separate the two. Doesn't mean necessarily that we'll have to succeed completely in separating them in order for it to be worth trying at all. So that's still a valid point. One more thing I wanted to say about this typology. Dr. Kotek said that there, in the band, tribe, and chiefdom, there's a kinship principle, right? That there's some kind of biological relationship between the people. Well, of course, it's not really
biological, because that's a Western concept, but there's some kind of relationship by marriage and birth between the people living in these kind of societies, whereas in state society, well, in our state society, there isn't, right? I mean, there's people from all over the world that come to America, and they're all citizens of the state. But is that always true? I mean, can there be a kinship principle of any kind in a state society? I mean, I think this is a really interesting sort of dilemma for a lot of states. Because, I mean, America's kind of different because we have this whole ideology that we're a country of immigrants. But, I mean, many states have a different kind of ideology which has to do with ethnicity. So take Germany, for example, since that's a kind of extreme example, maybe. There's an idea in Germany that there's something called German ethnicity, right? And somehow having German ethnicity has something to do with living in Germany in some kind of a way. It's this principle that basically was behind the idea that East Germany and West Germany should be one country, right? They're two separate countries, but they're all German, so they should all be one country. So we should bring the two of them together. At the same time, there's a lot of immigrants in Germany as well. And there was some debate over, I mean, now immigrants to Germany can have citizenship, but that's a really recent change. Up until about 2 years ago, there were different kinds of citizenship for people who were German and people who were not ethnically German, because there is an idea that you know, to be German. It comes down to a kinship principle, a lot like you find in a band, a tribe, or a chiefdom. That basically what you're saying, when you're saying people have, you know, an ethnicity, like they're all, I mean, it doesn't just have to be Germany. That's just a good example. But, I mean, every country in Europe, and most countries in the world, actually, not every country, but most countries have some kind of idea of what it means to be really from that country, and it has to do with ethnicity. And ethnicity, you know, is some kind of idea about blood and relatedness, and we're all the same in some kind of biological, cultural way that ties us together. So it's not a kinship where I could trace my kinship or tell you exactly, you know, everyone in this country is my cousin or something like that, but in a way it's still not as different from the way that these other kinds of governments organize themselves as we might originally think. So I just wanted to throw that out. Okay, give me all your papers, and do you have any questions? And please, if there's anything that you said in class that you don't want to be used by this Lingua 6 project, talk to Janine.
You got my email back.
What's
about, like,
oh, yeah, no, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I was going to use a bigger one. Yeah. But I found it, so it's no
problem. Okay, no. I just want to know if this is, like, a problem. Like, I was having problems with, like, cost of, like, affordable stuff. Like, uh-huh. They didn't really show any in the movie.
Yeah.
And, like, the book doesn't really touch on all that much. Like, it talks about our society. So, like, I said, like, a cost that they can't support it with the people, and, like, they can be pushed out of, like they talked about it in, like, Sheldon, whatever, talks about it, is that, like, one thing that led to
this
is the fact that, like,
they didn't have
any societies can't survive in certain areas.
Yeah.
Push there, like,
that's a good point.
Okay. I just wanted to
show you. Okay, cool.
Hi.
Oh,
that's a good question.
Because you know how you say that there's ethnicities, there's states. Do you think they'll ever eventually, because the world seems to be going towards an interconnected kind of general, like, you can be an American, but there's no, like, you're not, it's not like you're German. You know, you're American, but you're of Italian descent.
Yeah.
Do you think there'll ever be, like, a differentiation between that type of state, like America?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say that there is, in a way, because, I mean, this is just, like, a way of classifying
right.
things, so you can just classify it differently.
I just wonder if, like,
but, yeah, there
years
could be
down the road, if it comes to the point where there's no more real ethnicity-based things, if they'll take it out of the state system.
I think that could easily happen, and also the other thing that people talk about, and I don't know if this is, you know, true or not, but they say that the whole state system could be moving towards ending because the, you know, transportation and communication is so much better that being bound into one particular, I mean, states are basically based on land, so, but if you could just, you know, take an airplane and be somewhere else or get on the internet, you know, where you actually live becomes less and less important,
right.
So that's definitely another thing that would change the...
That's an interesting one to see. It probably won't happen in this life.
I don't think so. Not too soon anyway, but we'll see. I mean,
no,
you know.
It's a slow process.
It is.